Blog Talk Radio.
The year, 1888. The place? London's East End. Dead and mutilated bodies are popping up all over, from Stamford to Whitechapel. Jack the Ripper is leaving his mark, and the city's on edge. Yvonne Mason is back with a tale of murder and millinery. The Rhodes Hat Factory is booming while the body count rises. Why now? How are these hats connected? Has the Hatter gone mad? Mad Hatter, Yvonne Mason. Available now on Amazon.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason, and yes, that was a piece of shameless promotion, but I'm kind of like that. It's one of my favorite ads, because a friend of mine, Chris Dunham, known as the Odd Man, he did that for me, and he absolutely made it so real that I can just see the wheels of the carriages going down the cobblestone streets in the East End of London with the fog rolling in, and the Mad Hatter running around doing what he does. This is the first show of this week. It will be the last full week that I do shows before the beginning of silly season next Thursday. That's what I call the 30 days between Thanksgiving and New Year's is the silly season, because it is very silly. It's too commercial and it's too, oh, I don't know. We forget about all the things that it really should be and go for all the other things. But that being said, so we will have our regular shows tonight, Thursday night, Friday night. I will be on the air for 2 hours on Saturday night. The first hour will be a guest on my friend Paige Roberts' show, and we'll be having a roundtable discussion. And then in the 9 o'clock hour, I'll have my friend Floyd Potts on the show, and we will be discussing only God knows what. And then the 30th, my friend Tom Futrell, better known as the Reaper, will be a guest. But tonight belongs to someone who I dearly adore. I feel like he's one of my youngins from another mother. And his name is Ian Bush. He is an author, and he is a Michigan native and has been writing stories for 13 years. His first self-published novels, The Story Has Soul, was released in 2010. Ian is the winner of the Two Moon Press 2012 contest for his novella, Wishes for the World Around You, and his work can be found in the anthology Satan's Holiday, Shadows and Light, number 1 and 2 and 4, A Merry Scary Christmas, Spectral Hauntings 2, Don't Look Back, Blessings from the Darkness, Devolution Z and 47-16, a David Bowie's tribute anthology. Ian has also co-authored a novella, Guidelines for Mortality, with Ron Brown, and he can be found, of course, at Facebook and Amazon and everywhere. All you have to do is just go look for him. This young man has been a busy, 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 busy young man. Thank you, Ian, for being here tonight. I'm so, so excited.
Thank you for allowing me to be on the show.
Oh, allow? Really? Allow?
I mean, this is a huge show now. It's getting more and more views each time that you do a show. So I'm just honored to be on for even just an hour.
Oh, come on. Come on. Now, you've known me long enough to know that I am very loyal to those who have been loyal to me down through the years and who have been my friends and my confidants and my moral support through some very tough times. And it's an honor. I am honored that you have taken the time in your busy life, because you've got a baby. And
yes,
and
I do.
You have things going on in your life, so for you to take an hour out of your day, thank you. I appreciate it.
Of course.
That being said, let's talk a little bit about your journey, because we always say it's not the destination, it's the journey. Tell me what got you from point A to writing all these wonderful novels in horror, and how you got here, your pitfalls and your successes, and was this your first choice?
Well, I started pretty young. I started about in fourth or fifth grade. So in elementary, I knew this was something that I wanted to do. And it was kind of brought on to me by my parents, because my dad and I used to read Pick Your Own Adventures. And so it just, every time we read that, I loved those moments with him. If no one's ever read one before, you pretty much go through and, you know, it says if you turn to page 80, this will happen. If you turn to page 92, this will happen. And so you just keep going through until you either make it through the adventure or, you know, you don't make it through the adventure, and then you get really frustrated and go back to page 82 and take the other route because, you know, you can cheat like that. So that was what really got me into books alone. And then my dad, you know, he saw how much I really enjoyed doing this with him, and he just, it started with a question. He's like, you know, you can do this. You can write these stories, and you can bring this joy to other people. And, you know, in my little fourth or fifth grade mind, I'm like, I can? He's like, yeah, you can do this, and you can bring joy to other people and you know, share the same moments. And so it started then, and it started kind of funny because when I was in class, instead of taking notes, I shouldn't be admitting this, all my teachers are like, no! Instead of taking notes, sometimes I would get a story idea and jot it down real quick. And you know, Ian, what are you doing? Taking notes. That's some page-long, thorough notes you're taking.
I want to pass my test. I'm writing down every word you say because I don't know what's going to be on your test. I understand that.
So it was kind of weird, because then when I started writing these stories, I had classmates who were like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm making a book. And they're like, that's kind of cool. Can I make a book with you? So started making friends that way. And then it went to the teachers. And the teachers are like, well, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm making a book, a story, an actual book. And I'm like, yeah, like anybody can write a book. And so it seemed like when I was going to the next level, these teachers would tell the other teachers in my next grade, hey, he's writing a book. So just keep inspiring him, keep pushing him, you know? So, you know, this went all the way up to about 11th, 12th grade, where I had an English and a theater teacher who said, you know, hey, I heard you writing a book. And, you know, that was a typical thing at that time, where I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm just writing a book, no big deal. And she's like, well, let me look at it. And she looked at it, and she revised it and gave me her take on it. And, you know, I got in touch with the school librarian, same thing. She's like, here, you're writing a book. Yeah, I am. Why does everybody know I'm writing a book? I don't understand. And
typical for me.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing it for so long that, you know, even if it wasn't anything good, it's just that muscle memory of, hey, I'm just writing a book, what I do. And so 11th or 12th grade, I heard that there was a contest for local high school authors to submit their stories. And then if they won the contest, you'd be put into an anthology. And my high school teacher said, I really think you should put in for it. I'm like, well, I don't know. You know? And she's like, no,
maybe
I'm
not so
teacher.
Much.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, not so much. And she's like, no, I really think you should. So I took the plunge, and I submitted, and then it was around Christmas, I remember. I can't remember what year for the life of me. I think it was around 2011 time frame. 2010, I got the phone call, and they said that I won. So that's the journey. I mean, it was a very long, long journey, but it's my journey, and I enjoyed every step of it.
Well, that being said, Ian, and we'll talk about this more towards the end of the show, but the thing was, you continued that journey, and fortunately for you, you had the encouragement of first your father, and then of all of your teachers who passed that information along to encourage you and keep you on that journey, whereas so many, myself included, were totally discouraged. I didn't have sense enough to put two words together, much less form a sentence, which would form a complete story. I had more red ink on my papers than I think they had pens. But to have the support that you had at that young age says a lot for the open-mindedness of your teachers and your father, because they saw something in you. And so your journey was not, even though it was, and time-wise might have been a long journey, it was not, you were not alone on your journey.
I would agree with that. I definitely had a lot of fellow adventurers, and, you know, sometimes still I get calls from my classmates, you know, what's a new book? What are you doing? And I'm like, man, we've been out of high school for, you know, about 4 or 5 years now, and you're still asking me, that was my thing, you know, you're still asking me what I'm doing, and you're still motivating me along, and I really appreciate that of them.
And what that does is that makes you want to be even better at your craft, because you're very good at your craft, because some of your stories have appeared in my books, and you have an insight into the genre that you write in that for someone as young as you is unheard of. It's like you have all these life experiences that most young people, because writing what you write is, what's the word I'm looking for? It takes a special kind of person to bring that genre into play and make it believable. And you do that really well.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
You plumb scary sometimes. And I love it.
You know.
It's
good to find a crowd that enjoys the same kind of craft.
Well,
I mean, it definitely, like you said, it takes a unique person to write what we write, but we do it.
and as Alice in Wonderland said, when the Mad Hatter told her that he was insane, she says, "Well, all the best people are, so I guess we are among good company with ourselves." But that's okay. We understand each other.
Of course.
What kind of books, what authors did you read growing up? And did those authors influence the genre that you write in?
So it started with the earliest I can remember is The Boxcar Children, tell you the truth. Reading The Boxcar Children, and the only reason I remember that was because my grandma would entice my reading by hiding dollar bills in the pages.
Smart woman.
I know that's funny to look back to now, but, you know, again, about third or fourth grade, she told me, you know, Ian, if you read through this book, there's $1 bills that when you reach a certain point, it falls out of the book, but you can't go through the book and, like, you know, flip through all the pages very quickly, like the dollar bills just won't come out. It's magically held. So, you know, third grade, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, seems legitimate. And then I accidentally dropped the book one day and the dollar bills fell out. I'm like, magic's been broken. I don't understand. This isn't right. Like, what's going on? You know, I didn't read that page. So that's what started my love for journeys and just doing activities that were out of the norm. You know, you have these stories that these children are going on their, if I can recall it correctly, they're solving mysteries and they're, you know, trying to get to the bottom of things, and that really sparked my interest. From there it went to Tolkien with The Lord of the Rings. That's where I got my love for the fantasy world. Again, going to that adventure thing. You always had these adventurers doing something. They were doing big things. They were saving cities and worlds, and that was pretty big for my very, very young mind. And then from Tolkien, it went to Robert E. Howard from Conan the Barbarian series and a little bit more current R.A. Salvatore. I love R.A. Salvatore books. It seemed like when the Pick Your Own Adventure became a little too childish for me, my dad was like, well, let's go into this series. He showed me R.A. Salvatore, and I've been hooked ever since. It's been a family thing for me and my dad. We used to buy the latest book for Christmas every year. And always, it was always kind of a joke because I knew I was going to get a copy, and I knew he was going to get a copy. So we just kind of look under the Christmas tree until we found what looked like a book, and I'm like, I know what this is. So I've been very fortunate to surround myself with authors, so many authors that I can't even think of right now. Ray Bradbury, you know, all these authors that just, when I kind of get in a low spot, I go back to them, and they're old friends for me. So.
Now, a lot of our listeners might not know what Ray Bradbury wrote, because when I was a teenager, I loved reading Conan the Barbarian. I'd forgotten the author, but he was amazing. And then Ray Bradbury just brought the world to life on so many levels that you really were in the jungle with Tarzan.
And my favorite was Fahrenheit 451. That really sparked my interest in the firefighting, coincidentally, for some reason. That's what really started it.
And that segues into my next question. How in the world you got started as a volunteer firefighter?
It's something I've always wanted to do. I've done a lot of volunteer activities, but when I was about 13 or 14-ish, I was dating someone at the time, and her father was a volunteer firefighter. And, you know, it just, the whole lifestyle about it was just so neat to me at that time, because that's something that I never saw before. And so he would tell me, you know, some of the calls that he's been on, and tell me, you know, when the pager goes, I got to go, you know, and it just seemed like such an interesting lifestyle. So you're telling me this little black box tells you to go, and you just go, and you don't question it, you don't anything, you just go. He's like, yeah, and I'm not scared. And I go in, and later on he did admit to me, yeah, you know, there are times that I am scared. However, you know, at that time I can't be. And so that really inspired me. And I was like, that is just the epitome of the coolest person I've ever heard of, that you do things that nobody else wants to do because you're trying to, you know, save a person or save a house or, you know, even the small things. Even if it's just I fell and I can't get up,
right,
you're still there at that person's worst moment to make that person's worst moment maybe just a little less worse.
And you do it with a giving heart.
Of course. There's nothing that I want to take from it besides the experience and just the opportunity to serve. And I love being a volunteer firefighter. So when I came out to the place I'm living at right now, I looked around, and I made some phone calls because I saw there's a couple of volunteer fire departments. And then it was a pretty simple process. I joined, and they voted me on, and I've trained, and I've worked with these individuals. And, you know, we've had a lot of goosebump inspiring memories with these folks, just the laughs and, you know, sometimes the sad moments, you know, all of those make this volunteer journey worthwhile. And that is just so invaluable to me. I think that's something I'll hold with me to the very last day.
Oh, absolutely, because you will carry all of those life experiences are building blocks on the foundation of your life, and as you travel your journey, they will come in handy at some point on a different plane than just rushing into a fire or just rushing to get a cat out of a tree, because in some places they still do that. But all of those things you experienced as a volunteer firefighter, and ladies and gentlemen, my son-in-law was a volunteer firefighter. These men and women do not get paid to rush in to danger while others are rushing out. They do it because the change begins from within them, and they want to make a difference if it's one person at a time. So I very much admire your dedication and your love for doing something like that, because not everyone can do that.
I really, really appreciate that. That means a lot.
Now, on a fun note, now that we've been serious for a moment, ladies and gentlemen, that's why it's called Off the Chain. We go off the chain. We go from one to the other because we can. Your bio says that you are a professional disc golf player. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
First, what is that, and how in the world did you get involved in it?
So there's a couple of different terms for it. It's frisbee golf. It's disc golf. It's some of the other newer terms for it. Frolfing, I've heard. Regardless, disc golf is a competition where you take a disc, and they're all various sizes, and they all do various things. And you essentially go on what's called a tee pad, and you can play through woods, you can play through water, you can play through pretty much anything. And you attempt to throw a disc into a basket in as few strokes as possible. So it's like golf, where, you know, you want the lower numbers and, you know, you have negatives. It's essentially the same thing, but with disc golf. And I got involved with it kind of by mistake. And it's kind of taken control of my life, just like firefighting and writing and all the other things that I do. It was just kind of a whim thing. I had a group of friends in high school. I think we were freshmen, and they told me about this sport that they were playing, and I was like, that seems really silly. Like, so I'm throwing this little piece of plastic in this, it's called a pin, which is like a metal basket with chains. I'm like, so what's the big deal? You just put it in the basket. It's done. It's over. And they're like, no, there's so much more into it. And they went into, you know, exactly what I stated, that you have discs that when you throw it perfectly straight, they turn left. And if you throw it perfectly straight, they turn right. And if you turn your wrist this way, and if you, you know, put the disc in your hand this way, and I'm like, whoa, this is so, so much. I'm just going to go out there, and I'm going to throw a disc, and I'm probably going to hit 16 trees. And I'm just going to go have fun with it. And so I did, and that kind of caught on. We actually had one day that I think we played four different courses. So we played like whatever 18 or 24 times four is. I can't even remember how many holes we were playing.
A lot.
But we made a whole day of it. Yeah, we made a whole day of it. And, you know, ever since then, it's something that means a lot to me, because it's one of those things that you can do until your very final day. I've seen 60, 70, 80 year olds still playing disc golf, and they love it, you know.
I've never heard of it. I must check this out. It sounds interesting.
And it's always good to get a good group of friends. I mean, that's what makes it. You can surely play alone, but when you have a good group of friends and one of them hits what's called an ace, where you tee off, and I mean, this isn't a small tee. This is a couple, 300, 400, 500 feet, and they get in the pin the first time, just that moment that they're so happy and you're so happy for them. A group of people definitely makes it more fun.
And you build relationships that way, because you could take somebody you just met and build a friendship just by playing disc golf with them.
Yes, ma'am.
Which leads me to another segue. See how this works? Things just roll into a segue. You have a passion, and this passion mm-hmm. involves a mutual friend of ours, and I think you mm-hmm. know who it is. And I would like for you to tell our readers, now, is Armand going to be doing it again this year?
I hope so. I'm pretty sure he is. I'm pretty sure he's still going strong. And I'm so proud of that group and just so happy to know him and see just how much one person can do that just benefits so many people.
Will you tell the folks, number one, what it is and how to get in touch with Armand if they want to participate? Because I really believe this is something that is needed.
Of course. So Armand has a group called Authors Supporting Our Troops. And what he is requesting is that published authors send signed copies of books to him, and he will send them to remote locations overseas to men and women in the armed forces, and they will get author-signed books, and it's something that they can do while they're at these locations.
And ladies and gentlemen, Armand doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but Armand does not get a dime for any of this. Does he pay for all the postage?
I believe that there's donations as well. That's the other part of it, is that if you aren't a published author, you can still help out one of two ways, by either donating to help with the costs, because it gets expensive, especially every author knows when they're shipping their own books in the United States, let alone shipping it to some of these bases overseas, it can be pretty expensive. Or the second option is you can get with an author that you know and tell them, you know, hey, I would love to purchase X amount of books and have you sign them and send them in honor of me for Authors Supporting Our Troops. So either way, you know, it's a win-win for everyone. And when I heard this idea, I was just shocked. I was so shocked that one person would even, you know, make so much impact. But he has year after year.
And his name, ladies and gentlemen, is Armand Rosamilia. He can be found on Facebook. Look him up under my friends list or even under Ian's friends list. And you would be surprised at the impact that one book has on a service personnel in a remote area where they have no family. But they do have family, because the family is their brothers and sisters in arms. But to know that the people from the States care about them enough to do something like this, and I know how expensive it is to ship books. I have shipped books overseas, and it's very, even one book cost $15, $20 to ship. So when you ship a box load of books, it can run into the hundreds of dollars. So support this, Books for Troops with Armand Rosamilia, and go on my Facebook page or go on Ian's Facebook page and look up Armand and see how you can contribute, because this is just one more thing that we can do to tell our troops how much we appreciate them and how grateful that we are that they run into danger while we're running out. Now,
he actually
again,
has a permanent Facebook. He has a permanent Facebook page as well called Authors Supporting Our Troops. So if you want to see some of the impact that these books do, they post photos of incoming and outgoing. I know Armand always posts, you know, thank you so-and-so for sending books, and he'll give them a little bit of airtime that way. And then, fortunately, some of the remote locations will send photos of the troops opening the boxes and send them back to the Facebook page, so we get to see the end result. So that Facebook group is Authors Supporting Our Troops, and it's kind of a very humbling thing to look at when you see how happy they are. So.
And how grateful.
Oh.
And speaking of being recognized, you were nominated for the Volunteer Presidential Service Award. What was that?
So what that is you have to have a certifying official certify that you've done a certain amount of volunteer hours. And so once they certify that your age range meets the requirement for the award, you pretty much get submitted, and then they send you an award back. So that was pretty big for me. I was submitted in 2014 and 15 and received the award, and hopefully 2016, I mean, the year's not over yet, so hopefully 2016 will be a good year for me too.
Well, I tell you what, you have accomplished a lot, my friend, in a small amount of time. But again, we go back to what we've talked about, that the change comes from within ourselves. We can scream, you know, we can go out and ride in the street and destroy property and burn down buildings and get on national television and show the world how stupid we really are by answering a question that's so off the wall, even if someone with a minimal education looks at you and just shakes their head because it doesn't even make any sense. Or we can do as you do and have the change come from within and be the change that you want to see happening. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think that's something that's always been really big with me, is just leaving behind things that are a little bit better for everybody than when I got it. And some people would call that like leaving a legacy behind. And I think that's been my main drive, is to always be that person that somebody says, you know, if Ian didn't do that, or Ian didn't do this, or I didn't meet Ian, my life would be totally different. That comes with, you know, my family as well. My family's a big, big motivator. And I try to do all this just to make them proud and to make them have goals like I do. And, you know, it's sometimes a struggle, but like we stated earlier, I've had a pretty good support system, and it's done pretty good for me. So I think that's the biggest thing that everybody needs in this world, is just somebody to run behind them in that marathon and be like, you're not tired, you're not this, you're not that, you can do it. That's the biggest thing out of all of this.
And hold you up when you think you're going to fall. You know, someone on each side of you grabs your arm and helps you over that finish line. And we all need that. Because no man is an island. We all need people in our life that when we decide we're going to fall down into that pit of despair, that somebody's looking over the abyss and going, hey, what are you doing down there? Aren't you lonely yet?
Well, and I think it's people specific too. I don't think people necessarily need true human life people. You know, I know some people that are satisfied with going home and seeing their pet, or going home and reading a familiar author, whatever it is that they can turn to get them out of that spot. You know, I think we get hung up on networking and relationships, and sometimes it's just simple just to have a cup of coffee and enjoy the outdoors, you know.
You are absolutely right, because sometimes I agree with you, we need that solitude in order to regenerate our batteries and our inner peace, because there are times that we need that quietness. Because I think sometimes we get too much of a sensory overload with everything that is going on in the world.
Definitely right now, too. Definitely.
Especially with all the political rhetoric that's going on. Now, on another lighter note, as we
we have ups and downs.
Yeah, well, isn't that about life, though? I mean, you go from, can't
it's
get
true.
Too serious. Life,
at least
can't
we're
get too
strong
serious
enough
about
people.
Life. Cause, yeah. None of us are going to get out alive, so why be so serious? You
well,
did.
Well, at least we're strong enough people, too, that we're like, we'll just keep pressing, and then, okay, here it comes. We don't mind going to those low valleys, because we know we're going to come back up eventually.
Exactly. Your first book, This Story Has Soul.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to ask the typical journalistic, or should I say, investigator questions. Who, what, when, where, and how? And it doesn't have to be in that order.
So this was my first published quote-unquote story.
Yes.
It was, man, I'm so bad with years, but I feel like I was a junior in high school, so probably 2009, 2010. And it was after so many years of writing, I finally said, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make a book. And at this time, I don't think I was aware of all the self-publishing options and all that. I was still in high school, so I was pretty young. So I kind of took it in my own hand. And I was like, you know what? I am going to buy a ream of paper, and I'm going to print these stories. And the front cover will have a, now looking back, bright, very, very, very bright green cover. And it's just going to be a normal story. And I'm gonna sign it, and I'm going to go around high school, and I'm going to tell people that I did this, and this is my book. And I want you to read it, and I want you to tell me what you think. And so that's exactly what I did. I charged, I think, maybe like $5, some very low price, because I wasn't worried about making money. I was just worried about making enough money to go buy more paper and ink when it was out. And so I would sign the book, and people would come back and say, you know, this is good, this is bad, this is indifferent. And so it was my first published story, but it really solidified everything that I needed to know as an adult in the book industry, if you will, in the author industry, because, you know, I learned, you go to your classmates, you tell them, I have this book. So those are the people that I need to go to. And then you make just enough money to where you can keep writing comfortably, which I was. I was still printing out books and still getting ink, and it was okay. And you just do it because it's something that you enjoy, and you just want people to have a good time for a little bit and forget about their surroundings. And so that was the weirdest, best book I've ever wrote and sold.
And again, it goes back to your dream of writing. It solidified the fact that you had a craft, you were honing that craft, and you wanted to share that craft. Because, ladies and gentlemen, for those of y'all that don't write, but you have a passion and you haven't pursued it, trust me, once you start pursuing that passion, you cannot not do it.
Right.
Am I right?
You're
have to write.
You're completely right.
If we don't, we will go even more insane than we already are. We have to put pen to paper. And this is what Ian was saying. He had to get that book out there, even if he had to do it himself. And talk about being innovative in high school is brilliant. Because
I mean,
now I'm sure those kids that have that book are going, wow, I've got his very first book, and he printed it out himself.
Well, it was something that I don't even know what inspired me to do it just myself. And I think that's kind of the strange thing about this entire thing is that I don't know how I got the tools. So it's almost like a true muse came and talked to me and said, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that. And I think that's where what you stated earlier, that you have to keep writing. I think that's you just get hungry for it. You get,
yes.
You sometimes get so down in the dumps when you don't put pen to paper, and then a couple months go by and, you know, life happens. I understand. That's kind of what I'm going through right now, where life's been happening, haven't been writing as much. But then you come back, and it's just like for anybody who's ever worked out, it's your writing muscle aches, and you're like, oh man, I wrote like a page. Am I done yet? Like this is hard again.
I'm so tired.
Yeah.
But if you don't answer the muse's call, if you don't answer the voices in your head, do you find yourself spiraling downward into almost I don't want to say depression because it's not really a depression, but it's like a loss because those voices are saying, I want out of here. Put me down on paper. I've got so many things I need to do and say and places to go and people to murder. If you can't get it on paper, it's almost a physical pain.
I think more for me, I become more introverted. I'm a pretty extroverted person. I like to go and I like to meet people. I love book signings. I love people emailing me. Like, email correspondence with me is awesome. If somebody just emails me and just wants to talk about writing or anything like that, I'm all for it. I'd rather have that dialogue. But I've noticed that when I don't write, I begin to write books in my head. And I sit there and I daydream, and I'm just like, man, that'd be a really good book. Too bad I don't have the muscle to put it on paper. So I kind of enjoy it for myself. So I still find a little bit of satisfaction out of it, but not as much as when, you know, you're doing the talk shows and when, like I said, back in high school, when someone comes up to you and they're like, this book is really good. And you're like, really? Well, thank you. Like, that's so cool. So
it feeds our inner ego, because I think most of us as artists sometimes have fragile egos because we haven't learned how to rein them in and grow a thick skin, especially when we first start out. I mean, there are those of us that really, and some artists literally give up their craft because they cannot handle the criticism or the indifference, because they all want to be loved. Well, first we got to love ourselves, and then if the rest of the world wants to fall in line, fine. If not, that's okay, because I've got enough love for me. I don't really need a whole lot of people. I don't know about you.
I mean, I take people's criticism pretty seriously. But then I kind of take a step back, and I forget what the website is, but I always Google writer rejections, like famous writer rejections.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll kind of put me back on the right track, where it's like, you know, like, so-and-so had 60 rejections, and then that 61st submission, they became a New York Times bestseller.
Right.
So that kind of realigns me when I take criticism too seriously. I kind of do that, and it's like, you know, it's okay. It's just one person out of the 60 that I need to talk to.
And what people that criticize artists don't understand is, art, whether it's music or whether it's a piece of artwork or whether it's a book, it's all about perception.
Mm-hmm.
It's the characters write the book. We are just the facilitator. The characters write the book, and then the person you can take. It's like doing a witness interview at a train wreck. You have 10 people. Those 10 people are going to give 10 different stories, and those stories are not going to be lies or wrong, but the perception of what they saw is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with a book. You can take 10 people, have them read the same book, and you will get 10 different perceptions from 10 different people, because it all comes from within the person who's reading that book or sees the train wreck.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why I enjoy anthology so much, and why I feel comfortable and don't want to leave that niche, because essentially for the listeners who aren't familiar with anthologies, it's such a weird thing, because you just go on the page and they're like, okay, this is the subject. I need all of you to write about dogs. And then you have 20 authors or 30 authors or how many get picked. And they all write something different about a dog. They write, you know, maybe a good experience with a dog, a bad experience with a dog, the time that, you know, they saw a homeless dog on the street and they didn't do anything and they wish they could. And you put all these into an anthology and, like, your mind is completely blown, because you're like, there are so many things that you can write about in regards to dogs I would have never known unless I didn't take up this anthology subject. And I think that's really neat.
Are you ever going to do a full novel?
um, You know, it's the novella was hard. That was definitely pretty difficult. That was my first step to the novel direction. No pun intended. So I would like to. That's my next goal, but I got to get a subject that that I can really write on. And unfortunately, going back to the muscle analogy, you get used to writing a certain way. You get used to, you know, okay, well, this is how we start, and oh, okay, this is about a good midpoint. Let's wrap it up really quick. And the novel, you gotta kind of spread it out a little bit. You gotta kind of spread out the action and all that. So, you know, novels are just like, you get to that, oh, let's wrap it up real quick. And you're like, no, this is a novel. We gotta keep trucking. So I think right now I'm not ready for
it. You gotta add three dimensional to it. But you did a beautiful book with a co-author, Ron Brown, and, mm-hmm. and it's called, ladies and gentlemen, it's called Guidelines for Immortality. Now, the story is about guideliners and deliverers. Mm-hmm. And the deliverers were the people who delivered justice. The guideliners killed to become alive again. Yes. Explain this to me. This sounds so interesting.
So when I was doing a book signing, I met Ron Brown at one of my favorite coffee stores, like, in the entire world. This coffee store made my horrible addiction to coffee, and I will forever be grateful for that, because that's the baseline. When I drink coffee, I'm like, is it as good as that book? Is that a coffee store? No? Nah, not my coffee. So I was there, and I was having a book signing, and he came up, and Ron Brown started talking about how it seems like we're getting into this creative funk with books and with movies, and it's just the same thing over and over. And he's like, I want to get away from that. I want to do something different, and I have different ideas, and I want to take all that, you know, normal, quote-unquote, stuff that people are writing about and just throw it on top of its head. And I totally agreed with him. I'm like, this is great. It's not very often that you find someone who shares that same experience where they're like, let's do something new. And so he told me about a story that he thought about in regards to guidelines and deliverers, about how there are people who are different around us, but you can't tell until you see their true colors. And so, as you previously stated, one side is trying to kill to become human again. And I took that in, like, a metaphorical sense, that we all kill ourselves a little bit to get some kind of humanity sometimes, you know, be it, I got to go to work, and I can't stay at home and write. You know, that might be a death to some people, metaphorically. And so the other side, they try to bring justice where justice needs to be brought. And so that was kind of the basis of the story, is that you have these two sides fighting, and you don't know which side's going to win until you read the end, you know? And so it's a constant battle, and that was definitely one of the more challenging books, again, because what I previously stated with anthologies and short stories, so easy to get to the middle and be like, oh, this is so good, let's wrap it up before, you know, I have to stretch it out and feel like I put too many words in. With a novella, I had to really flex that muscle and say, nope, I need to finish the story in its entirety. I cannot get to a point where it's a cliffhanger and then say, okay, drop it off. No, we gotta develop these characters. We gotta, you know, answer all the questions and get everything right the first time. So it was definitely a challenge. I wouldn't mind doing another novella again, but at this point in life, we're gonna stick with the anthologies. That's still something comfortable for me.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to start another anthology, because that's the only way I'm going to get you to write for me again. Ladies and gentlemen, he has been in three of my anthologies, and If you haven't read Satan's Holiday or Blessings from the Darkness or A Merry Scary Christmas or Welcome to Your Nightmare, Ian is in three of those. And he has an insight into people's psychic that most young people wish they had or think they have and they don't. His short stories, you want to read them over and over and over again because every time you read them, you get something new out of them. So go and find his anthologies, the anthology Satan's Holiday, Shadow and Light, 1, 2, and number 4, A Merry Scary Christmas, Spectral Hauntings 2, Don't Look Back, Blessings from the Darkness, Devolution Z, and 47-16, which is a David Bowie anthology, and then also the novella Guidelines for Immortality with Ron Brown. Ian, honey, if you keep writing like you're going, by the time you're my age, you will be on the New York Times bestseller list.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That really does mean a lot.
Well, I'm very proud of you. I've watched you evolve in the 3 years. Ladies and gentlemen, this kid and I, and I say that in a loving way because I feel like you're one of my kids. This young man and I have had a friendship for 3 years. I knew him before he got married. I watched him get married. I watched he and his beautiful wife, Samantha, have a beautiful, beautiful baby named Winifred. And you have a beautiful journey ahead of you, my friend. And I am so, so proud of you.
And, you know, it's the feeling's mutual. I've definitely enjoyed our conversations, the ups, the downs, and the in-betweens, you know, and I do truly value our friendship and the group that we created. So,
yeah, it's been a journey for us all. Now, we've got about 7 minutes, and tell everybody where you can be found, and then I'm going to ask you a question. And the question is, what do you tell dreamers? How do you explain to dreamers to make their dream real? But first tell people where you can be found, and then answer that question for me.
Alrighty, so the biggest place that you can find me is Gmail. Like I stated earlier, I love it when people email me. So it's iancbush@gmail.com. So iancbush@gmail. And you can email me and we can have email conversations for days. I'm totally cool with that. New writers, young writers, no artists, some artists. I'm good with anything. So you can find me with The Story Has Soul. I still send that out every once in a while, but not so much anymore. So if you ask for a copy, I might be able to scrounge one up. You can find me in Satan's Holiday, Shadows and Light 1, 2, and 4, A Merry Scary Christmas, Spectral Hauntings 2, Don't Look Back, Blessings from the Darkness, Devolution Z, 4716, David Bowie Tribute Anthology, and my novella, Guidelines for Immortality with Ron Brown. You can find me on Amazon, and you can find me on Facebook, author Ian Bush, and then Ian Bush on Amazon. And the advice I would give, this was tricky for me to think about while I was telling you where you can find me, because advice is hard. it's very
okay,
hard
let's change,
to come
let's,
by.
All right, let's change the advice to suggestions.
Even suggestions are hard to come by because when in today's information world, you get so much stuff, and that's probably the advice I have is that you get, you know, I tested this theory a little while ago. I got 83 million results in under a minute in Google with the search with keywords tips on writing a book. I've purchased more books than I care to admit and all different ways to spin how to write. I've been asked so many times to give advice. And my only advice is to take every piece of advice you can get and use it if it applies to you. Figure out what you are. Are you a day writer, a night writer, a fast writer, a slow writer, a fiction writer, nonfiction? Just write. And, you know, the muse doesn't always pull, but when she does, you got to listen, or he. You know, you can still doodle, you can still free write, just write and take all the advice that you get and tuck it in your back pocket and just go forth and conquer. Don't be scared. There's always somebody you can ask to help you along the way, including me. So.
Well, do you agree that no one can steal your dream without your permission?
Of course. Only you're the one who can make your dream come true.
and sadly, that happens in our lives, is we allow others to steal our dreams for whatever reason or excuse. And then at the end of our days, and I say this at the end of every show I do because I feel so strongly about it, at the end of our days when we're taking our last breaths and people are saying, well, do you have any regrets or is anything you would do over or yada, yada, yada along that vein, and we're sitting there going, well, I shoulda, I coulda, I woulda, but I didn't. And then it's too late. And like you and I were talking about before the show, we only have this moment in time. We don't have tomorrow. We don't even have 15 minutes from now. We're not promised that.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
I completely agree. Too real for words, honestly.
So if we take what we have in the moment and we make that moment count, then the next moment we will make count, and the next moment we will make count. And pretty soon we see that dream begin to evolve, just like you writing your book, starting in, 12, 13 years old, you started writing that book, and you made every moment count, even when you were supposed to be taking notes. You made that moment.
Sorry,
count.
Teachers.
I think it's brilliant. You made that moment count because it was important. It was your dream. Because, number one, your father said, you can do this, and you believed him. Therefore, you believed yourself, and you never allowed anyone to take that dream away from you. So, Ian and my suggestions to each of you out there is, if you have a dream, if you have a passion, if you have a platform, you make the moment that you have right now count, and then you make the next moment count. And before long, you're going to see that dream become real, and you're going to ask yourself, why did I wait so long? Am I right, Ian?
Of course, it's your dream. You just got to own it, you know. That's the key. And then, like you said, moments become days, days become months, and then before you know it, you're doing what you want to do. And I think that's everybody needs to do that. I think everybody needs to take a moment to progress themselves, even if it's just not writing, just something. If you want to make pottery, just take like 5 minutes to work on a piece of pottery, you know, just something. Everybody needs something.
So with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, they're going to cut us off here. With that in mind, I wanted to tell you that we will be on tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And I did not write my guest name down, but you know they're going to be great. And thank you, my dear friend, for the honor of you agreeing to come on my show and spending an hour of your time with me. I am so grateful to have you in my life. You are a wonderful human being, and I just appreciate you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, remember, it is your dream. No one can steal it without your permission. So join me tomorrow night. This radio show is a 5-year dream. It is now up and running, 5,000 listeners. You can be on this show. All you got to do is contact me. I don't care what you do. Let's get you on the show. Join me tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. The show will go into archives. You can download it. It will go on several podcasts, including iTunes and YouTube and Stitcher. So until tomorrow night, this is your host, Yvonne Mason, and we are off the chain. Megan, you just hang around a second.
Will do.
All right, now we're off the air, but anything we say is will go into the archive show and people will get to hear it. But what I wanted to tell you is when I put the podcast up, you know, you see me put the podcast up once I download it on the different sites, I'm going to tag you in it, and then I want you to take this show and use it to promote yourself.
Okay.
Okay?
No, and I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been... been great talking to you. I wish we had more time to sit and talk more often.
I'm going to bring you back after the first of the year. Forgot to tell you that on the show. I'm going to bring, because I like bringing my guests back so that they can stay out there. So when I get back to my desk, I'm going to find what date, and then I'll send it to you. And if it's good for you, if not, we'll do another date. But you're going to become a regular on the show.
Thank you so much. How do you think I did?
I think you did excellent.
It's been a long time since.
but you're a natural, my friend. You are a natural. So now you got to get some more workout so we can talk about it.
Of course. I'm doing a NaNoWriMo right now. So are you doing NaNoWriMo?
Right. Well, now we can talk about it on the next show. That'll be perfect.
Okay.
And kiss Samantha and Winifred for me and tell them that they're very special in my life.
Of course.
And I will talk to you later, my friend.
Of course. Thank you for the opportunity. Have a good night.
All right, John. Good night.
Bye.